Can cranberry juice help prevent urinary tract infections?
Long-term follow-up, menopausal hormone therapy.
What about cognitive dysfunction after you've been in the ICU?
And the cardiovascular safety of diabetes drugs.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on October 4th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas, San Antonio.
Rick, I'd like to turn right to the Journal of the American Medical Association, to this study on cranberry juice and its potential ability to prevent that very common problem in women, often urinary tract infections. This is, of course, a recurring theme, so I am very interested in what this study shows.
Urinary tract infections are really among the most common medical conditions, especially in the primary care setting. There are more than 1 million hospital admissions annually in the United States for this condition. And cranberry products, either the cranberry juice, tablets, or capsules, have been used really for decades to prevent and to treat urinary tract infections. This study was just a simple question, are they effective? This was a Cochrane review. All the available studies out there, everything published between 1994 and 2012, over 4,400 patients included in these studies. Overall, although the cranberry products appeared to be safe, there was really no suggestion that the cranberry products actually reduce the incidence of urinary tract infections.
Oh, this is so very disappointing. And I guess I've heard lots of women talk anecdotally that they do feel that they help. So I am disappointed in this.
In the studies that used primarily cranberry juice, there was really a problem with adherence. In other words, you have to drink so much of it to get some of the active ingredient. Many of the patients really weren't adherent with it. So it doesn't really settle the issue, but what they were able to say is the available evidence that we have doesn't suggest that there's any association between its use and decreased incidence of urinary tract infections. What the authors of this Cochrane review suggest is let's do additional studies with larger doses, known quantities.
So since we're talking about women and we're in the Journal of the American Medical Association, let's look at another recurrent issue, hormone replacement therapy.
Now, Elizabeth, when we've talked about this in the past, you roll your eyes at me like, do we have to talk about this again? You still have that feeling?
I do still have that feeling.
Let me put this in perspective, because I think that this is important on several fronts. The Women's Health Initiative was conducted in the mid-1990s. Almost 162,000 women were enrolled and studied under various conditions. One was the effect of hormone replacement therapy on overall health and cardiovascular disease. During this study, women were randomized to either placebo or to the combination of estrogen and progestin if they had a uterus. Or if the women didn't have a uterus, they were randomized to just estrogen. And in 2002, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute stopped the estrogen and progestin trial because the risk outweighed the benefit. Then in 2004, they stopped the estrogen alone trial, again feeling that the risk outweighed the benefit. But subsequently, they've had an observational period. That observational period has now extended for 13 years. And that's what this study addresses in JAMA. What they conclude is that overall, the risks seem to outweigh the benefit. There's no evidence that hormonal therapy reduces mortality or reduces cardiovascular risk. In fact, there are several increased risks associated with it. Increased risk of breast cancer, stroke and thromboembolic events, incontinence, increased risk of dementia as well. That outweighs any putative benefits.
As you know, I have been a fan for a long time of not selecting hormone replacement therapy. I am sympathetic to women who have a lot of troubling issues when it comes time for menopause, but I really feel that other strategies ought to be employed before anyone should seriously entertain this option.
And what the studies show here is that it's very effective in controlling the vasomotor symptoms associated with menopause. If they're severe and debilitating and unresponsive, then this is an effective therapy. But we shouldn't be prescribing it to women with the intention of decreasing their mortality or decreasing the risk of cardiovascular disease, because it doesn't do that.
Then there's also, of course, the lack of benefit when it comes to the cognitive dysfunction also. So I'm going to use that as our segue into the New England Journal of Medicine, looking at a very important issue as far as I'm concerned, and that's cognitive function after someone's been in the ICU.
Those of us that take care of patients in the ICU can all point to patients that after they've been in the ICU, they have a long-term disabling form of cognitive impairment or dysfunction. Some individuals get over it and some don't. Anecdotally, we know this occurs. this was a particular study to give us an idea of the prevalence or the incidence of it. And also, if it occurs, is it long lasting? I found this a really well done study. They took 821 patients with respiratory failure or shock that were in the medical or surgical intensive care unit. They evaluated them for in-hospital delirium. They looked at what medications they received, particularly sedatives and hypnotic agents. Then they did a global assessment of their cognitive and executive functions at 3 months and 12 months. And here's what they discovered. 1 out of 4 patients had cognitive impairment 12 months after their critical illness that was similar in severity to patients that had mild Alzheimer's disease. And 1 in 3 patients had impairment typically that was associated with moderate traumatic brain injury.
What was the impact of age on this cohort?
That's an interesting question, because you think, gosh, this must be worse in the elderly. In fact, there was no difference. It was true in elderly and young patients. There was no association with use of sedatives or hypnotic drugs. There didn't seem to be any associated with certain comorbidities, but there was an association with the length of delirium during their hospital stay.
I'd also be interested in the prevalence of cognitive dysfunction per diagnosis. Why are they in there?
Well, these were all individuals that had respiratory failure or shock. By the way, none of these had anoxia or hypoxemia. None of these individuals had decreased oxygen flow.
Well, certainly there are a lot of ongoing studies, and here at Hopkins, a number I'm aware of, that are taking a look at sedation in the ICU and trying really hard to make sure that people are not sedated in order to cope with some of the problems with being on the respirator and all that sort of thing, and also to try to get them out of sedation as quickly as possible, get them ambulatory as quickly as possible, even strategies for having them exercise while they're in the bed, sometimes passive exercise as well, to try to reduce this particular problem.
Well, the authors of this article and also an associate editorial make the association between inactivity and cognitive dysfunction as well.
I guess where I'm headed with this is just wondering if there's an underlying propensity toward this already, just as a part of someone's individual genetic makeup, for example, and that this is just the event that kind of exposes that.
That's a great question. This study doesn't answer that, but the authors raised the exact same issue. Is there a genetic predisposition, or is there what they call a particular amount of organ reserve? And then once you exceed that, your illness causes you to exhaust that organ, in this particular case, the brain, it just doesn't recover.
We'll definitely keep an eye on this one. Finally, also in the New England Journal of Medicine, something that is potentially good news, and I say that with a little dose of cynicism, just because a lot of these new mechanism drugs sometimes turn out to be troublesome when we release them into the population at large, but something new for diabetes.
There are a number of agents available, oral agents, that one can use to lower the serum glucose. We've talked about in the past that we've gauged how successful these agents are by do they lower the glucose, and if so, then we would assume that it reduces the complications, one of the major ones being cardiovascular disease. But studies of other agents have raised the concern that actually, even though they may lower the glucose level, they increase the risk of cardiovascular disease. And that was an issue with a group of medicines called glitazones, like rosiglitazone and pioglitazone. So with this new group of medications are called DPP-4 inhibitors. There were 2 studies done in diabetics, one with a DPP-4 inhibitor called saxagliptin, in which they looked at almost 16,005 patients with diabetes who were at risk of cardiovascular disease, and then another agent called allogliptin, in which they studied over 5,000 patients with diabetes who had an acute coronary syndrome. And what both studies show is that these agents do reduce serum glucose, and they are not associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease.
No doubt there's going to be something else that shows up on the horizon when these things are used longer term, when they're titrated up to the proper dose, that we're going to find out that there's some other interaction or what have you. So while it's really great that we're trying to take a look at cardiovascular risk with regard to diabetes drugs, I feel absolutely certain that something else will appear. That doesn't mean it's not going to turn out to be a great drug. It just means that we know that there's going to be some risk-benefit ratio.
And that's why it's important that we do post-marketing studies that reveal that complications that happen very infrequently or may be limited to specific populations that we may not even study in these phase 3 studies.
Okay. On that note, I'll just tell our listeners, consumers, that here in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration has recently opened an adverse events reporting system where they're asking consumers to report side effects of drugs. And this, of course, would be the perfect kind of a circumstance to utilize that system. So I think that on the blog this week, I'm going to let you pick, Rick. Which one do you think I should do?
I think the cranberry juice was kind of interesting. I'm not sure we've ever reported on that before. Let's put that on the blog.
Okay, cranberry juice it is. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I was a visiting professor last week at Scott and White Hospital. I want to tell our listeners there hi. I'm going to sign off. I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.